This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Ghosts of the Shadow Market, Book 8, Through Blood, Through Fire, by Cassandra Clare and Robin Wasserman. Read by Candace King.
Once upon a time, in a land not so far away, there was a child who should not have been born. A child of disgraced warriors. His blood, the blood of the angels. His birthright forfeit while he slept, unknowing, in his mother's womb. A child sentenced to death for the sins of his ancestors. A child spirited away from the law that condemned, and the family that couldn't yet know how much they might someday need him and his progeny. Once upon a time, a child was lost, or at least, such is the story told by those foolish enough to lose him. No one is ever lost to himself. The child was simply hiding, as his child and his child's child learned to hide, and on through the generations, evading those who hunted them. Some seeking forgiveness, some seeking annihilation, until inevitably, that which had been hidden was revealed. The lost child was found. And that was the end. Later, when Jem Carstairs tried to remember how the end began, he would remember the tickle of Tessa's hair on his face as he bent close, breathed deep the scent of her, which that day carried a hint of lavender. They were in Provence. So of course everything smelled like lavender. But Tessa was alive with it. Breathing her in was like breathing in a sunlit meadow, a sea of purpling blossoms, springtime itself. That was what Jem would remember later. The desire that time stop, freeze the two of them inside this perfect moment. He would remember thinking, with wonder, that this was how it felt to be perfectly satisfied. When Tessa Gray returned to that moment, the moment before, she remembered the taste of honey, which Jem had drizzled onto a sliver of baguette and popped into her mouth. The honey, fresh from the hive behind the estate, was almost painfully sweet. Her fingers were sticky with it, and when she pressed them into Jem's soft cheek, they didn't want to let go. She couldn't blame them. Memory has a tendency to fog the mundane. What Jem and Tessa were actually doing, bickering about whether the cheese they'd acquired that morning was goat or cow, and which of them was responsible for eating so much of it that a second trip to the fromagerie was required. It was a lazy, loving bickering, as befit their sun-dappled afternoon. They'd come to this retreat in the French countryside to strategize about the lost Herondale, who they had recently discovered was also heir to the Seelie and Unseelie courts, and so in more danger than anyone had ever imagined. This estate, the use of which had been offered by Magnus Bane, was a safe, quiet place to plan where to go from here. The lost Herondale had made it very clear to Jem that she didn't want to be found. But Jem worried this was because she didn't know the depths of danger she was in. They needed to find her. Warn her. Now, more than ever. The urgency was real, but so was their inability to do anything about it, which left many hours to fill, gazing out at the sunlit hillside, and at each other. Tessa had nearly decided to give in and admit that Jem was right about the provenance. Goat, if wrong about who'd eaten the most, Tessa, when a tiny light sparked between them, like a tiny falling star. Except it didn't fall. It froze in midair, getting brighter and brighter, blindingly bright, and forming itself into a familiar shape. Tessa sucked in a sharp breath. Is that a heron? Jem confirmed. Years before, Jem had enchanted a silver pendant in the shape of a heron and pressed it into the palm of a young woman with Herondale blood. A young woman in danger who steadfastly refused his help. "With this pendant, you can always find me," he had once promised, in the silent voice with which he had once spoken. Jem had been Brother Zachariah then, still bearing the robes and duties of the silent brotherhood. But this mission and this promise had nothing to do with the brotherhood. Jem was still bound by it, would always be bound by it. "I trust you will summon me for help, if and when you need. Please trust that I will always answer." The woman he'd given that pendant to was a Herondale, the last heir of the lost Herondale, and the silver heron meant that, after all these years, she needed him. As Jem and Tessa watched, the bird traced letters of fire upon the air. "I turned away from you once, but please help me now. I thought I could do this on my own, but the riders are closing in. If you will not come for me, come for my boy. I thought I could buy his life with my suffering. I thought if I left him, he would be safe. He is not. Please come. I beg you. Save me. Save my child. Rosemary Herondale." The light winked out. Jem and Tessa were already in motion. In the century and a half they'd known each other, much had changed. But this truth endured. When a Herondale called, they would answer. LA traffic wasn't as bad as everyone said. It was exponentially worse. 6 lanes, all of them nearly at a standstill. As Tessa inched forward, shifting lanes every time a space opened up, Jem felt like he was going to crawl out of his skin. They'd portaled from France to Los Angeles, emerging halfway across the city from the source of the distressed call. Magnus had reached out to his network of West Coast acolytes and secured them transport to get the rest of the way. The turquoise convertible didn't exactly scream incognito, but it was enough to carry them the handful of miles from Echo Park to Rosemary Herondale's house in the Hollywood Hills. The ride should have only taken a few minutes. It felt like it had been a year. "I turned away from you once, but please help me now." The words echoed in Jem's mind. He'd spent decades searching for the lost Herondale, finding her, finally, only to lose her again. But after she'd refused his offer of protection, he'd made her a promise. He would come when she called. He would save her when she needed saving. "I thought I could do this on my own." James Carstairs would always come to the aid of a Herondale. He would never stop repaying the debts of love. She had summoned him using the necklace, and he would do everything in his power to honor his promise. But, "Please come, I beg you. Save me." There was more than just one life at stake now. "Save my child." What if they were too late? Tessa put her hand on Jem's. "This isn't your fault," she said. Of course she knew what he was thinking. She always did. "I had her, and I let her walk away." Jem couldn't stop picturing it. That morning on the bridge in Paris, when he begged Rosemary Herondale to accept his protection. He had asked a Herondale to trust him and been judged unworthy. "You didn't let her do anything," Tessa pointed out. "She made her own choice." "The Herondale way," Jem said wryly. "You let her know you would always be there if she needed you. And now that she does, I'm twiddling my thumbs 5 miles away, useless." "Enough!" Tessa abruptly swerved onto the shoulder of the road and sped past the clogged lanes, then careened onto the first exit ramp they came to. Instead of slowing down, she picked up speed as they hit the surface streets, weaving wildly from lane to sidewalk. Soon, finally, they found their way into the hills, the road narrowing to a single lane of hairpin turns bounded by a vertiginous drop. Tessa didn't slow down. I know you have superhuman reflexes, but trust me, she said, infinitely. He couldn't tell Tessa the other reason he felt guilty. It wasn't simply that he'd let Rosemary slip through his fingers all those years ago. It was what he'd done for her since, which suddenly seemed like next to nothing. Ever since he'd sloughed off his life as Brother Zachariah and fought his way back to James Carstairs and back to Tessa Gray, the other half of his soul, his heart, his self, he'd given himself permission to be happy. They'd visited shadow markets all over the world, keeping watch for Rosemary, always searching for ways they might be able to assist her from a distance. They'd even visited the market here in LA several times, but they had found no trace of her there. What if, despite his best intentions, Jem had missed something? Some opportunity to find and help Rosemary before it was too late? What if, lost in his own happiness with Tessa, he'd enabled her suffering? The car screeched to a stop in front of a small Spanish-style bungalow. The yard was a riot of color. Monkey flowers, hummingbird sage, desert mallow, jacaranda blossoms. A gauntlet of sunflowers watched over the path to the door, nodding in the breeze, as if to welcome them. It's like a house from a storybook, Tessa marveled, and Jem agreed. The sky was an impossible blue, dotted with cotton candy clouds, and the mountains on the horizon made it feel like they were in an alpine village rather than the middle of a sprawling metropolis. It's so peaceful, she added, like nothing bad could ever happen here. She was interrupted by a piercing scream. They erupted into motion. Jem shouldered the front door open, readying his sword to face whatever lay beyond. Tessa followed close behind, her hands sparking with angry light. Inside, they found a nightmare. Rosemary, lying still in a pool of blood. Looming over her, a massive fairy, his body covered in thick bronze armor, a long sword raised overhead, its point aimed straight at Rosemary's heart. In many ways, Jem Carstairs was no longer a shadow hunter. But in the most important ways, he would always be a shadow hunter. He launched himself forward, a whirl of deadly motion, sword stick a silver blur as he hacked at the fairy with the full righteous force of shadow hunter rage. His blows glanced off the creature's body without leaving a single mark. Tessa raised her hands and dispatched a blinding white wave of energy at the fairy. He absorbed it without flinching. Then, almost carelessly, grabbed Tessa in one massive hand and flung her across the room. She slammed into the wall with a thud that caused Jem physical pain. Jem threw himself in the fairy's path, kicked, spun, swung the sword down sharp and sure in what should have been a mortal blow. Any ordinary fairy, any ordinary downworlder, would have been felled. This one only laughed, shoved Jem to the floor, and pinned him there beneath a massive foot, leaving Jem helpless to do anything but watch as the longsword found its mark and stabbed Rosemary through the chest. The fairy stepped back, freeing Jem to rush to her side. Too late. He tore off his shirt, pressed it desperately to Rosemary's gushing wound, determined to keep her life from draining away. Too late.
I have no quarrel with you, Shadow Hunter, the fairy said, then gave a sharp whistle.
An enormous bronze steed crashed through the bungalow's front windows in a hail of glass. The fairy hoisted himself onto the horse.
I suggest you refrain from quarrel with me.
The horse reared and leapt into the air. And just like that, horse and rider were gone. Rosemary's face was deathly pale, her eyes closed. She was still breathing, if barely. Jem put pressure on the wound, willing her to hold on. Tessa knelt beside him. He let out a sharp breath, his heart clenching. Are you hurt? I'm fine. But Rosemary. Tessa gripped Rosemary's hands and closed her eyes in concentration. Seconds passed as she summoned the will to heal. He could see the effort written on her face, the torment. Finally, Tessa turned to Jem, a hollow look in her eyes. He knew what she would say before she said it. It's a mortal wound, she murmured. There's nothing to be done. Tessa had volunteered as a nurse during one of the mundane world wars. She knew a mortal wound when she saw one. And Jem, during his decades in the Silent Brotherhood, had seen too many Shadowhunters beyond help. Far too many in the Dark War. He, too, could recognize death in all its guises. Rosemary's eyes flickered open, her lips parted as if she was trying to speak, but she managed only a rasping breath. There was still one Herondale they could save. Your child, Jem said. Where is he? Rosemary shook her head, the effort of motion causing her obvious pain. Please, she whispered. There was so much blood, everywhere, blood. Her life streaming away. Please, protect my son. Just tell us where to find him, Jem said, and on my life, I will protect him, I swear. He stopped, realizing there was no one to receive his promise. The shuddering breath had given way to stillness. She was gone. We'll find him, Tessa promised Jem. We'll find him before anyone can hurt him. We will. Jem hadn't moved from Rosemary's body. He held her cool hand in his own, as if he couldn't bring himself to let go. She knew what he was feeling, and it hurt. This was the joy and punishment of loving someone the way she loved Jem. She felt with him. His guilt, his regret, his powerlessness and fury. As they consumed him, they consumed her too. Of course, it wasn't just Jem's guilt, Jem's fury. She had plenty of her own. Every Herondale was part of Will, and so a part of her. That was what it meant to be family. And she had knelt by the cold body of too many Herondales. She could not stomach another meaningless death. They would find Rosemary's son. They would protect him. They would ensure this death was not in vain, whatever it took. It's not just that she's dead, Jem said quietly. His head was lowered, his hair a curtain over his face. But she'd memorized his face, his every expression. She'd spent so many hours since his return gazing at him, unable to believe he was really here. Restored to life, restored to her. It's that she died alone. She wasn't alone. She's not alone. This was not the first time she and Jem had helped a Herondale into eternity. Once, she had sat on one side of Will, Jem on the other, both of them longing to hold on to him, both summoning the strength to let him go. He had been Brother Zachariah then. Or that was what the world had seen. Ruined face, sealed eyes, cold skin, closed heart. She had only ever seen her Jem. It still seemed a miracle that he could open his eyes and see her back. Wasn't she? Very gently, Jem unclasped Rosemary's necklace. He dangled the long silver chain, letting the hair and charm spin slowly, gleaming in the afternoon light. I thought this would be enough, a way to reach out if she needed me. But I knew she was in danger from the Fae. I shouldn't have underestimated that. I recognized that fairy gem, Tessa said. The bronze braid, the designs on his armor, all those etchings of the sea. That was Fal of Manon. She'd studied the writers of Manon during her time in the Spiral Labyrinth. Part of her efforts to better understand the fairy world. They were very old, ancient, even, from an age of monsters and gods. and they served at the pleasure of the Unseelie King. These were no ordinary fairies. They were more powerful. They were made of wild magic. Perhaps most terrifyingly, they could lie. Seraph blades are useless against the riders of Manon, Jem. They're born assassins, a walking death sentence. Once he found her, no power on earth could have stopped him. So then what hope is there for the boy? There's always hope. She risked putting her arms around him then, and very softly extricated Rosemary's hand from his grip. We find the boy first. Then we make sure the Fae never do. Not until we're ready for them, at least, Jem said, a note of steel entering his voice. There were those who believed that because Jem was so kind, so capable of gentleness and generosity, because Jem loved so selflessly, that Jem was weak. There were those who suspected he was not capable of violence or vengeance, who assumed they could hurt Jem and the ones he loved with impunity, because he did not have it in him to strike back. Those who believed this were wrong. Those who acted on it would be sorry. Tessa squeezed the heron charm tightly, its beak pricking sharply against the soft meat of her palm. She could feel Rosemary's essence simmering in the silver and reached for it with her mind, opening herself to the traces of the woman left behind. It was second nature to her now, changing into someone else. Usually, she only needed to close her eyes and let it wash over her. This was different. Something felt not wrong, exactly, but sticky. Like she had to yank herself out of her own form and forcibly shove it into another. The transformation felt difficult, almost painful, as it had in her earliest days in London. Her bones and muscles and flesh tearing and distorting themselves into alien form, body rebelling against mind, while mind fought its own battle, defending its territory against the colonizing force of an other. Tessa forced herself to stay calm, focused, reminded herself that it was always more difficult to embody the dead. She felt herself shrinking, fading, firm limbs narrowing to Rosemary's delicate, bony frame. And as she did so, the horror flooded in. Those final moments. The flash of the longsword, the hot breath of the fairy rider, the unthinkable pain and pain and pain of the blade thrust once, twice, and finally, fatally. The terror, the despair, and beneath it, the fierce, loving rage on behalf of the boy who must, somewhere out there, survive. He must, Tessa. Then Jem was there, steady, his arms on her shoulders, his gaze firm and kind, his love a tether to keep her from floating away. Jem, always, bringing her home to herself. Tessa, you were screaming. She breathed. She focused. She was Rosemary, and she was Tessa. She was the change itself, the possibility of transformation, the inevitability of flux, and then, mercifully, she was clear. I'm okay. It's okay. Even now, after more than a century of changing, it was strange to hear herself speak with another woman's voice, to look down and see another woman's body as her own. Do you know where he is, the boy? My boy. Tessa could hear the wonder in Rosemary's voice, could feel the other woman's ongoing surprise that it was possible to love like this. They won't have him. I won't allow it. There was fear, but mostly rage, and Tessa realized that they were not the Fae. They were the Shadow Hunters. This was one secret she would keep for herself. Jem didn't need to know that Rosemary had died as she'd lived, convinced they were the enemy. Let me go deeper, Tessa said. She spent years burying what she knows about him, but it's there. I can feel it. Rosemary's being was in a battle with itself. She'd been entirely consumed with her son, with the fierce need to protect him, but had also spent these years trying with all her might to forget him, to force all thought of him from her consciousness, for his own safety. She knew the greatest danger in his life was her, Tessa said, horrified by the sacrifice this woman had made. She knew the only way to keep him alive was to let him go. Tessa let herself sink into the memory. She let go of Tessa and gave herself wholly over to Rosemary. Focused on the boy, on the strongest memories of him and what had become of him, and let them possess her. She remembered. I don't understand, her husband is saying, but the desperation in his eyes, the grip of his hands on hers as if he knows what will happen when he lets go, that says different. That says he does understand, that this has to be the end, that their son's safety is more important than anything, more important even than the two of them, which Rosemary used to think was everything. Things were different before she was a mother. Christopher is 3. He looks like and unlike his mother, like and unlike his father. He is their love come to life, their two hearts intertwined and given shape and breath and cherubic cheeks and golden hair and a nose to kiss and a forehead to stroke and a perfect, perfect body that has never known pain or horror and never should. Must never. It's about him now. That's all that matters. But we're already so careful. For 1 year, they have forced themselves to live apart, in one small apartment, CD blocks from the Vegas Strip. Her son and her husband, who now calls himself Elvis, but who has been Barton and Gilbert and Preston and Jack and Jonathan, who has changed not only his name, but his face over and over again. All for her. In an even smaller, much lonelier apartment in a sad stretch of desert behind the airport, Rosemary, feeling their absence with every breath. She haunts their shadows, watches Christopher on the playground, at the zoo, in the pool, never letting him see her. Her son will grow up unable to recognize his mother's face. She allows herself monthly encounters with her husband. An hour of stolen kisses, and all the details of a childhood passing without her. But that was selfish. She sees that now. Bad enough that the Shadowhunters were able to get as close as they did. Now, the Fae have sniffed her out. She set up charms around the apartment, a warning system. She knew their emissaries had been there. Her position was compromised, and she knows what will happen if they find her. If they find him. You have to go deeper underground, she tells her husband. You have to change your identities again, but this time, I can't know what they are. If they find me, you can't let me lead them to you. And he is shaking his head. He is saying no, he can't do this. He can't raise Christopher alone. He can't let her go knowing he can never have her back. He can't risk her facing danger without him. He can't, he won't. He must. I have the Heron, she reminds him. I have a way to summon help if I need it. But not my help, he says. He hates the necklace. He always has, even before it was tainted with the Shadowhunter's enchantment. He tried to sell it once, without telling her, because he knows her heritage only brings her pain. She forgave him. She always forgives him. What if you need me? She knows he hates it, the idea that she would call on a stranger over him. He doesn't understand. This is because a stranger's life means nothing to her. She would let the world burn if it meant keeping Jack and Christopher safe. What I need is for you to keep him alive. The world believes Jack, for that is how she first loved him and how she always thinks of him. Is a crook. Untrustworthy, venal, without capacity for trust or love. Rosemary knows better. Most people are spendthrift with their care, spreading it around without discretion. Jonathan loves only two things in this world, his wife and his son. She wishes sometimes that he would include himself on that list. She would worry less for him if she thought he allowed any worry for himself.
Okay, but what if we win? He says.
What do you mean?
Let's say you defeat the evil fairies and you convince the Shadow Hunters you're of no use to them.
What if everyone just stops looking for you and for Christopher and it's finally safe to be together? How will you find us?
She laughs, even in her despair. He has always been able to make her laugh.
This time, though, he doesn't see the joke.
That's never going to happen, she says gently. You can't even risk hoping for that to happen.
Then let's go to the Clave, all of us. Let's throw ourselves on their mercy, ask for their protection. You know they'd give it to you.
This cuts her laughter off abruptly. The Shadow Hunters are without mercy. Who knows that better than she? She squeezes his hands, tight enough to hurt. She is very strong.
Never, she says. Never forget that the Shadow Hunters are as grave a threat to Christopher as anyone else. Never forget what they were willing to do to my ancestor, to one of their own. They will not get their hands on him. Promise me.
I swear, but only if you promise to.
There is no other way. He won't do what she asks, won't disappear forever unless she leaves one thin thread between them, one hope.
The place you first told me who you really were, he says. The first place you trusted me with yourself. If you need help, you go there. Help will find you. I will find you.
It's too dangerous.
You don't need to know where we are. You don't need to find us. I'll never go looking for you, I promise. And Christopher will be safe. But you, Rosemary...
His voice catches on her name, as if he knows how rarely he will allow himself to voice it again.
If you need me, I will find you.
They don't say goodbye. Between them, there can be no such thing as goodbye. Only a kiss that should last forever. Only a closed door. A silence. A void. Rosemary sinks to the ground, hugs her knees, prays to a god she does not believe in that she will have enough strength never to let herself be found.
I know how to find him, Tessa said, already pulling herself out of the change.
It was, again, harder than it should have been, an unfamiliar friction holding the Rosemary shape in place. Except it wasn't entirely unfamiliar, was it? Something tickled the back of her mind, a memory just out of grasp. Tessa reached, almost had it, but it skittered away. Gone.
It felt wrong to be in Los Angeles without checking in on Emma Carstairs, but Jem reminded himself that involving her in this could bring danger to her door, and the girl had faced enough. She reminded him of himself sometimes, both of them orphans, both of them taken in by an institute, adopted into someone else's family, but harboring, always, the secret pain of losing their own. They had both found salvation in a parabatai, and Jem could only hope that Emma had found in Julian what he'd always found in Will, not just a partner, but a refuge, a home. No one, not even a parabatai, could replace what had been lost. Even now, there was a hole in Jem's heart, a raw wound where his parents had been ripped away. This was a limb that could not be replaced, only compensated for, as it had been when he lost Will, as it would be if he ever lost Tessa. Loss was an inevitability of love. Pain, the inescapable price of joy. Everyone had to learn this someday. Maybe this is what it meant to grow up. He wished for Emma,
that her childhood could have lasted just a little longer, and he wished that he could have been there for her when it ended. But this was always the cold calculus when it came to Emma Carstairs, balancing his desire to be a part of her life with the consequences. When he was a silent brother, he would have been taunting her with something she couldn't have, her only remaining family, who could, nevertheless, not be her family. Now, as Jem Carstairs, he would have happily taken her into his care, but he was no longer a shadow hunter, and choosing him would mean Emma would have to give up her entire world. The law was hard. It was also, so often, lonely. He kept telling himself, soon. Soon, when he and Tessa had gotten their bearings again. Soon, when he had helped Tessa find the lost Herondale, that piece of Will lost to Will's world. Soon, when the danger had passed. He worried sometimes that these were all flimsy excuses. He'd been alive, one way or another, for almost 200 years. He should know by now that danger never passed. It only paused, and then only if you were lucky. "You sure this is the place?" Jem asked Tessa. She'd changed into Rosemary again, and he could barely look at her. Sometimes Jem missed the cool distance the Silent Brotherhood had forced on him, the way no emotion, however powerful, could penetrate his stony heart. Life was easier without feeling. It wasn't life, he knew, but it was easier. "Unfortunately, this is definitely the place." Every city had a shadow market, and in a way, they were all the same market, branches of a single tree. But that didn't stop each market from taking on the character of its environs. From what Jem could tell, Los Angeles's environs were tanned, health-conscious, and obsessed with automobiles. The shadow market was located on a tiny corner of Pasadena, and everything there was shiny, including its occupants. Vampires with bleach-white fangs, bodybuilding fairies whose bulging muscles sheened with gold-spangled sweat, witches with neon hair and self-writing screenplays for sale, ifrits hawking glittering star maps that on closer examination had nothing to do with astronomy, but were in fact self-updating maps of Los Angeles with a tiny photograph of Magnus Bane marking each location the infamous warlock had caused some infamous chaos. Tessa bought 3 of them. They threaded through the crowds as quickly as they could. Jem was relieved to no longer bear the robes of the Silent Brotherhood, the ineradicable mark of his creed. There was a taste of the frontier to the shadow market, a sense that the rules only applied here as far as anyone was willing to enforce them. Fairies cavorted openly with their fellow downworlders. Warlocks did business with mundanes that should never be done. Shadow hunters were, for obvious reasons, unwelcome. Their destination lay just beyond the buoyant chaos. In the liminal space between the shadow market and the shadows, there stood a ramshackle structure with no sign and no windows. There was nothing to suggest it was anything but a ruin. Certainly nothing to mark it as a seedy downworlder bar, home away from home for down-on-their-luck downworlders for whom even the shadow market wasn't quite shadowy enough. The last thing Jem wanted to do was let Tessa set foot inside, especially wearing the face of someone the Unseelie Court intended to assassinate. But since he'd met her, no one had let Tessa do anything. According to Tessa, Rosemary and her husband had a deal. If Rosemary ever needed him, she would come to this place, somehow make it known that she needed him, and he would appear. It was that middle part of the plan that seemed a little too vague for comfort, but there was no way out but through, Tessa had said cheerfully, then kissed him. Even in someone else's body, even with someone else's lips, her kiss was all Tessa. They went inside. Tessa went first, Jem following a few minutes later. It seemed prudent to appear they were not together. The bar wasn't much of one, It was just as ramshackle inside as it was out. The large werewolf bouncer at the door sniffed him once, warily, grunted something that sounded very much like, "Behave," then waved him inside. The crumbling walls were blackened by scorch marks, the floor spattered with beer, and by the smell of it, ichor. Jem surreptitiously clocked the other denizens for potential threat. One bikinied fairy slow dancing with herself, despite the silence, teetering drunkenly on her sky-high heels. One werewolf, wrapped in a tattered silk cape, slumped face down on the table, his scent suggesting he'd been there for days. Jem watched just long enough to make sure he was still breathing, then took a seat at the bar. The bartender, a wizened, balding vampire who looked like he'd been hiding from the sun since long before he turned, looked Jem up and down, then slid him a drink. The glass was spotted, its contents a filmy pale green. Whatever floated in the center looked like it might once have been alive. Jem decided it was probably safer to stay thirsty. Three stools away, Tessa hunched over a glass of her own. Jem pretended not to notice. The fairy sidled between them, her forked tail caressing the rim of Jem's glass.
"What's a guy like you? Etc."
"Excuse me?"
"You know, all tall, dark, and handsome, and..."
She shot a glance at the guy in the corner, now snoring with such a force that his table rattled beneath him with each exhale.
"Upright? You don't look like the kind of guy who would hang out around here."
"You know what they say about books and covers," Jem said.
"So you're not as lonely as you look, then?"
Jem realized Tessa, pretending not to listen, was suppressing a smile, and only then understood that the fairy was flirting with him.
"I could help you with that, you know," she said.
"I came here to be alone, actually," Jem said, politely as he could. The fairy's tail slipped from his glass to his hand, tracing up and down his fingers. Jem pulled away. "And, I'm married."
"Pity."
She leaned in, too close, her lips brushing his ear.
"See you around, Nephilim."
She strutted out of the bar, freeing Jem to concentrate fully on the conversation Tessa was having with the bartender. "Do I know you?" the bartender asked. Jem stiffened. "I don't know," Tessa said. "Do you? You look familiar around the edges. Little like a girl who used to come in here all the time with her boyfriend. Bad news, that guy. She wouldn't hear it. Head over heels, like only a kid can be." Out of the corner of his eye, Jem caught Tessa's slight smile. "Oh, I don't know that I'd put an age limit on head over heels." The bartender gave her an appraising look. "If you say so. Not this girl, though. She grew up to be the flaky kind. Ran off on him and their kid, I heard." "Terrible," Tessa said dryly. "And Mr. Bad News?" "Maybe not such bad news. Loyal enough that he's still coming back here after all these years. Kind of guy a certain type can lean on when they need help, if you get me." "And how would a certain type go about finding him?" Tessa asked. Jem could tell she was trying very hard to keep the eagerness out of her voice. The bartender cleared his throat, began half-heartedly wiping down the bar. "The right kind of woman, I'm told, would know exactly how to find him," he said, without looking at her. "Because he's exactly the same bird he used to be. Just a little less of a crook." He put special emphasis on the words, and Jem could tell by Tessa's expression that they meant something to her. His heart leapt. Tessa jumped to her feet and tossed a few dollars on the bar. "Thank you. Anything for the girl as pretty as a rose. Good luck to—" The dagger seemed to materialize in the center of his forehead. He was dead before he hit the ground. Jem and Tessa whirled around to find Fal of Manon and his bronze horse thundering through the doorway, bearing down on them with inhuman speed. Fal's longsword falling, Jem's body reacting before his mind had time to process every second of a lifetime of Shadow Hunter training poured into a storm of slashing, kicking, leaping, fighting. All this in under a second. All this ineffectual, because the blade was already falling, was dropping Tessa to the floor in a limp pile of blood and flesh. And Foul of Manon, impervious, had already taken flight by the time Jem dropped to his knees beside her pale form.
"I suggest you stay dead this time,"
the fairy advised, and was gone. She was so pale. Her features were melting back into her own. The change always released when she lost consciousness, but something was wrong this time, almost as unsettling as the wound. Her features had nearly returned to Tessa's when, like a taut rubber band suddenly released, they snapped back to Rosemary's, and back again, and again, as if her body couldn't decide whom it wanted to be. Jem pressed the wound, tried to hold in the blood, didn't care whom she looked like, just wanted her body to choose life over death. The fairy in the bikini. The thought cut through his haze of panic. Maybe she'd been planted there to spy for the Riders, knowing this place had special meaning for Rosemary and her family. Maybe she'd simply recognized Rosemary as a woman with a target on her back, a woman who was supposed to be dead and done her fairy duty. It didn't matter how it had happened. What mattered was that Jem had overlooked her as a threat, which made this his fault. And if Tessa didn't... But he stopped the thought before it could continue. The wound would have killed a mundane, maybe even a shadow hunter. But Tessa's body had shaped itself to Rosemary's form at the time of the attack, the form of a woman who was not just shadow hunter, but heir to the fairy throne. Who knew what magic the body might be working on itself in its struggle to survive? Maybe that was why the change wouldn't let her go. Maybe that was her body's way of staving off death until she could heal. Tessa moaned. Jem scooped Tessa into his arms, begging her to hold on. He had learned much about healing in the Silent Brotherhood, and he did what he could. He thought about how she'd sat by what they'd all thought was his deathbed, his supply of Yenfen finally exhausted, the demonic poison overtaking his system, and remembered telling her that she had to let him go. He remembered, too, sitting with the dying Will, giving him permission to leave. He didn't know whether it was strength or selfishness now, but he refused to do the same for Tessa. Not yet. They had waited so long for a life together. They had only just begun. "Stay," he begged her. "Fight." She was so cold, so light in his arms, like something essential had already fled. "Whatever it takes, you stay here. I need you, Tessa. I have always needed you." She wasn't dead. A full day had passed and she wasn't dead. But she wasn't awake either, and she hadn't stopped changing from Tessa to Rosemary and back again. Sometimes she lasted minutes, once even an hour, in a single form. Sometimes the change whipped back and forth so quickly that she seemed to have no form at all. Her skin was slick with sweat. At first it was cold to the touch. Then, as fever tore through her, it burned. She had been given medicines to staunch the blood loss, to give her strength, endurance. Remedies that Jem, no longer a Silent Brother, couldn't treat her with himself. The moment Jem had gotten her to safety, he'd summoned help. Or rather, because he and Tessa weren't part of the Clave and had no claim over the Silent Brotherhood, no power with which to summon, he'd asked for help. Begged for it. Now Brother Enoch was here, mixing tonics, enacting the complicated, secret rituals that Jem had once been able to do himself. Never before had he regretted leaving the Silent Brotherhood, returning to the land of mortals and mortal peril. But to save Tessa, he would have happily pledged the rest of his eternity to those parchment robes, that heart of stone. Instead, he could only stand beside Enoch, helpless, useless. Sometimes, Brother Enoch even made him leave the room. He understood. He had done the same himself, many a time, secreting himself with the patient, never giving much thought to the torture their loved one might feel on the other side of the wall. In his first life, Jem himself had been the patient. Tessa and Charlotte and Will, hovering anxiously around his bed, reading to him, murmuring in comforting voices as he swam between darkness and waking, waiting for him to get stronger and for the day he would not. Exiled to the hallway of the small apartment that Magnus, via his ever-expanding and ever-ambiguous network of friends, had secured for them, Jem sagged against the wall. "I'm sorry, Will," he thought. "I never knew. To watch the person you loved most fight for every breath, to watch them slipping away, powerless to hold on, to see the face you loved contort with pain, the body you would die to protect trembling, shuddering, broken." It wasn't that Jem had never endured this before, but always before, there had been an intercessor between him and the raw horror of absence. When he was growing up as a shadow hunter, Jem had always, in the back of his mind, been conscious of the fact that he would die young. He had known he would die long before Will or Tessa, most likely, and even when Tessa or Will flung themselves at danger, as they did so often, there was a part of Jem that had understood he would not be forced to stay very long in a world without them. There had been moments, too, in the Silent Brotherhood, when he had stood by Will or Tessa's side, uncertain if they would live or die, but the pain of that had always been mitigated by the same icy distance that mitigated everything else. Now, though, there was nothing in his way, nothing to distract his gaze from the terrifying truth of it. Tessa could die, and he would live on without her, and there was nothing to be done but wait and see. To endure this took all the strength Jem had. Will had never flinched from Jem's suffering. Over and over again he had endured. He had sat by Jem's bed, held Jem's hand, saw Jem through the darkest of hours. "You are the strongest man I knew," Jem said silently to his lost friend. "And I never even knew the half of it." The door creaked open, and Brother Enoch emerged. Jem still marveled at how alien the Silent Brothers seemed to him now that he was no longer among them. It had taken him some time to get used to the silence in his mind, the chorus of voices that had accompanied his every moment for decades suddenly gone. But now, he couldn't imagine it. It felt like trying to remember a dream. "How is she?" "The wound is no longer a mortal threat. Her shape-shifting abilities seem to have prevented it from having the expected effect." Jem nearly collapsed with relief. "Can I see her? Is she awake?" The Silent Brother's ruined face was immobile, his eyes and mouth sewn shut, and yet Jem could still sense his concern. "What is it?" he said. "What aren't you telling me?" "The wound is healing. Her changing has saved her. But I fear now it is the changing that poses the greatest threat. Her body, her mind are trapped within it. She seems unable to find her way back to herself. The change will not let her go. It is as if she has lost her hold on what makes her, essentially, Tessa Gray. How do we help her?" There was true silence then. No, Jem refused to accept this. "There's always been something. You have a millennium of knowledge to draw on. There must be something." "In all those years, there has never been a being like Tessa,"
She is a strong woman and a powerful one. You must have faith she will find her own way home.
And what if she doesn't? She just stays like this, in limbo forever.
The changing takes its toll, James. Every transformation requires energy, and no body can sustain this level of energy indefinitely. Not even hers.
The voice in Jem's head was so cool, so measured, it was easy to imagine he didn't care at all.
Jem knew better.
It was simply that caring, for a silent brother, took a different, alien form. This much Jem could remember. The icy distance from life. The inhuman calm with which events were processed. Words like care, need, fear, love. They had meaning. It was just a meaning unrecognizable to anyone who could sleep, eat, and speak, who lived a life of animal passions. He remembered how grateful he was for the rare moment, almost always a moment with Tessa, in which he felt a spark of true emotion. How he'd longed for the fires of human passion, for the privilege of feeling again, even fear, even sorrow. Now he almost envied Brother Enoch the ice. This fear, this sorrow, it was too great to bear.
How long then? You should go to her now. Stay with her until.
Until it was over, one way or another. Tessa knows and does not know that this is a dream. She knows that Jem is alive, and so this must be a dream. This corpse in her lap, wearing Jem's face, this body decaying in her arms, skin sloughing from muscle, muscle flaying from bone, bone dissolving to dust. He belonged to her so briefly, and now he is dust, and she is alone. He is cold. He is lifeless. He is meat, her Jem. Meat for maggots. And they swarm his flesh. And somehow she can hear them, chittering and gobbling, millions of mouths nibbling to nothing. And she screams his name, but there is no one to hear but the wriggling death worms. And she knows it to be impossible, but still, she can hear them laugh. Jem is alive, his eyes bright with laughter, his violin raised to his chin, his music, the music he wrote for her, the song of her soul, and the arrow that sails toward him is swift and sure and coated with poison, and when it pierces his heart, the music stops. The violin breaks. All is silence. Forever. He flings himself between her and the manted demon, and she is saved, but he is speared in half, and by the time she can catch her breath enough to scream, he is gone. The Dragonity demon breathes a cloud of fire, and the flames consume him. A blinding blue and white fire that burns him from the inside out, and she watches the flames shoot from his mouth, watches his eyes melt with the heat and run down his smoldering cheeks, and his skin crackles like bacon until almost mercifully, the light is too bright, all-consuming, and she turns away, only for a single moment of weakness, but when she turns back, there is only a pile of ash. Everything that was Jem is gone. A flash of sword, and he is gone. A wailing beast swooping out of the sky, a talon raked across pale skin, and he is gone. And he is gone. She is alive, and she is alone, and he is gone. When she can no longer bear it, when she has watched love die 10 times, 100 times, felt her own heart die with him, when there is nothing left but an ocean of blood and a fire that's burned away all but the excruciating pain of